much more climate resilient. And in integrating climate issues into all sorts of planning in agriculture, in the urban development field, in water planning, etc. Caribbean islands are already establishing hurricane insurance schemes and so on. So there is a lot going on with or without us. The World Bank itself, 18 months ago, adopted a strategic framework for development and climate change. And it's important again here to emphasize that we are not a climate bank and we will never become a climate bank. We will be a development bank that tries to address climate. And that strategic framework has already resulted in considerable increase in activities in a very sort of integrated and World Bank group manner. The World Bank Group, as was mentioned this morning, is more than the traditional bank itself. It also has the IFC, the International Finance Corporation, which is the private sector arm of the bank, and it's very much a part of this strategic framework. One of the key principles there we have to remember is that we are guided by the UNF framework for combating climate change process. We are not going alone. We are a part of that UNFCCC diplomatic sort of... We follow what's going on there, and whatever is decided there, we try to comply. Our work is country-driven, and it's demand-oriented, and the approach is tailored to meet the specific needs of clients. So the World Bank may be a global leader in some sort of global goods, public goods thinking, but what happens in the field, what the money actually, the big money is used for, is very country-driven. As a result of this strategic framework, for instance, the number of country assistance strategies that guide, that are the framework for all the assistance that we do in a country, jumped from something like 20-30% to 80% of all the strategies actually already address climate change issues. So it's very much being mainstreamed. Climate change is not only being addressed by specific funds and specific measures, it is being taken into account as an integral part of a country planning strategy. I think that's a very important message also for us to remember. And it's going more and more in that direction. There are direct sort of development policy loans going into climate change issues, for instance. That is more or less direct access of countries to money from the bank to actually tackle climate change on their own. But I was asked to say a few words about a pilot exercise. Demonstration or fund that was actually launched less than 2 years ago, the climate investment funds, to see if dedicated funds can actually be effectively mobilized and how they can be then programmed and operationalized. And it has been a remarkably successful exercise. Two big funds were established. One was called Clean Technology Fund, which is financing demonstration, deployment, and transfer of low-carbon technology. So this is really, I think, what is interesting to this audience, because you are dealing with the sort of development and deployment of technologies that reduce greenhouse gas emissions. $4.4 billion were pledged by the donor community. This is all official development assistance from the donor countries to a fund that is administered by the World Bank, but which is not programmed only and solely by the World Bank, but in partnership with all multilateral development banks. This means all regional banks, Asian Development Bank, African Development Bank, IDB, European Development Bank, or Bank for Reconstruction and Development. They are, and our IFC as well, so they are always programmed jointly and together with the recipient governments. There are a couple of details that I will give on each of the funds. The other one is the Strategic Climate Fund, which is more targeted to programs to pilot new approaches and scale up of new technologies. and there are about 2 billion already available. And these funds have one interesting element. They don't have the governing structure that is the same as has been traditionally been the case in World Bank and other multilateral development bank projects, but they actually have their own governing bodies that are 50-50, that have equal representation from developing and developed countries. And that has, of course, made, and all decisions have to be made by consensus, which means developing countries can veto any program that they would feel that is not fit to be funded under these funds. So they are pilots, and they have a sunset clause if something better, if they don't work or if something better is identified. But for the time being, they are very much being programmed. The Clean Technology Fund, in fact, has already been fully committed. The 4.4 billion have been already identified, have been sort of tied into 13 investment plans, and those investment plans include other investments up to 36 billion. That means these 4.4 billion leveraged another $36 billion of money from other sources. So the investment plans are owned by the recipient governments. And the Clean Technology Fund is just a small portion of that thing. And there's a lot of funding from other regional development banks, the governments themselves, expected revenues from the carbon market, and resources from private sector financial institutions. About 30% of all the leveraging was from the private sector. So I think they are an interesting example of something that could actually be multiplied if more resources are made available. There's a couple of them are addressing transport, but none of them is addressing aviation at the moment. But transport is very much there. We have the Mexico example has a very strong element, low carbon bus rapid transit systems, for instance, and then we have lots of energy efficiency in them. The newly approved Thailand investment plan also has a major component in transportation in the Bangkok metropolitan area. Another fund is the pilot program for climate resilience, which addresses adaptation directly, and it's the first operational program under the Strategic Climate Fund and one of the first funds in the world that is dedicated actually to sort of trying to make vulnerable countries integrate their climate risk and resilience into their core development planning. Again, all the demand was so high that all the funds have actually been committed, the 1 billion or so. And participating countries have been identified, and the first tranches have already been identified for Zambia and for Nepal. So this all the programming, identification of countries and programming took less than 2 years. And the next 2-3 years, I think most of the funds will sort of more or less be fully out of our hands. There are two other smaller funds under that climate investment funds. That one relates to forestry, which is not really in your domain, and one relates to scaling up renewable energies in low-income countries, which mostly relates to access to energy sources by the poorest groups. So again, we are talking about something that is not of direct relevance here. I think you had a special session on carbon market development already, so I will not go much to that, but it's important to remember that the World Bank actually piloted the first carbon fund already 10 years ago, and then it eventually sort of was scaled up and the world took over, and now there is a carbon market out there. It's scattered, but it's sort of working, and we are hoping to see a future to it if there is a new Kyoto Protocol or something else that actually gives some clarity on the future price of carbon. But the World Bank itself is administering 11 carbon funds worth $2.5 billion. It runs two new funds that support developing countries in being better users of carbon markets. One is the Carbon Partnership Facility, which really tries to sort of make developing countries that are not good at tapping this resource ready for the market and looking for innovative ways of going to the carbon market. And I think that might be also interesting for you. And then the Forest Carbon Partnership Facility, which supports country readiness to participate in the new RED programs, and that is very much making progress at the moment. But the carbon market is something that we see very much in connection with the rest of the sort of our climate approach. So carbon revenues are an element of a bigger picture, not the only solution, but they are a very important part of the solution. And of course, the World Bank has also found a way of mobilizing finance via capital markets for so-called green investments or using products and instruments that are closely related to climate. We have all sorts of green bonds, cool bonds, eco-notes that are actually successfully mobilizing additional, in a way, clients that are buying World Bank assets that would otherwise not be buying them. And that improves, of course, our fiscal situation, brings more resources to be then allocated to developing countries. There are weather hedges, there are Caribbean catastrophe reinsurance facilities, for instance, an interesting example of a Mongolia index-based livestock insurance project, which really kicked off this winter when there was a very, very cold winter and so much of the cattle died. Now, actually, this insurance scheme has been able to keep the insured farmers afloat. One service that we are in the process of setting up, and it's not fully functional yet, but it's already worth mentioning, because in a half a year or a year or so, there will actually be a full service on the web. It's called Climate Finance Options Knowledge Platform, which we are putting together with the UNDP, other regional development banks, including the Inter-American Development Bank, who are hosting the Spanish version for Latin America, and with the UN system. And there we will have really pre-digested, detailed data through a search engine available for project planners and policymakers in developing countries actually to find out what sort of funds can be made available for a very specific type of an investment. And it's not only dedicated climate funds, it's any fund that could also be used for such an investment. And it also gives a lot of best practice examples from a number of countries, particularly in blending, combining, packaging various sources of finance, including the carbon market, so that people would see the point of not only staring at one possible source, but looking into the bigger picture and trying to find a way to, through some small grant funding, lowering the overall investment cost through a private source, for instance, and that way passing the hurdle and being able to actually invest in something innovative or revolutionary that would otherwise not be commercially feasible. There are lots of good examples, and I'm sure biofuels are one example, and we have a lot on renewable energy, solar heating, whatever. And it will have a very detailed knowledge center with a huge library on climate finance issues. It will have a lot of investment decision-making tools to help to arrive in better decisions, including, for instance, biofuel scorecards and things like that. One thing that we keep on repeating is, in this global environment, developing countries expect to trust the donor community in the messages they're giving and in fulfilling the commitments they've made. And we advocate for increasingly reliable, comprehensive and transparent reporting to demonstrate that new climate finance instruments are not introduced at the expense of those targeting other development objectives. This is really a very important, I think, message also from the UN system. We know that this whole issue of is something additional or not. You will never be able to answer it fully, because you cannot separate incremental expenses for climate action entirely from the other investments. In mitigation, it may be a bit easier. In adaptation, it's virtually impossible. But we still advocate much more detailed monitoring, some coding and tracking systems that are actually comparable. And of course, if there are levies that, like the world is talking about, levies from, for instance, aviation fuel or maritime fuel, that's easy to demonstrate as a new source of income for climate action because it's not a part of official development assistance, ODA. Whereas ODA donors can classify in various ways what they use their money for. The OECD has a system of RIO markers that is trying to keep track of this, but we all know that they are qualitative, they're policy markers, and they don't actually give quantitative information. I don't want to go much into this, but I just want to mention that there, when we talk about the whole big issue of climate finance, a paper from the IMF a couple of years ago, 3 years ago, actually did advocate on indirect taxes on international aviation and maritime activities. Maybe that was already discussed here earlier, yesterday or 2 days ago, I don't know. That paper said that it's on pure tax policy grounds, the case is strong. Optimal version would likely to include the combination of both of excise on use of fuel or equivalent emission charges and ticket tax based taking in the form of value-added tax or something, rather than trip charges that they found very unsuitable. And they also recommended the same for fuel consumed by ocean-going vessels, which are currently not taxed. This is just one of the many levies that is on the table. And I'm mentioning this because now the United Nations Secretary General did establish a high-level advisory group on climate change finance, which has started its deliberations and which is reviewing all those options that are on the table. And these levies are there, together with a very, very large number of other ideas, but we heard that none of the options is off the table yet. And that's why it's important to know that this is happening, and it's happening very soon, because this committee or advisory group is expected to submit its final recommendations to the president of the outgoing president and the new president of the climate conference before Cancun. And this is a high-powered committee that has two prime ministers. As I said, one prime minister lost his job last week, so we don't know now if his successor will take over. And a large number of very eminent individuals in their individual capacity, and I have been already sitting and giving a lot of background information to a number of their subcommittee chairs, so there's a lot going on. And they are asking everybody now what is there and what do you suggest and all that. So we hope that there will be some really reasonable proposals for the negotiators. But of course, all the decisions on the future financial architecture are political, and we as a World Bank have absolutely nothing to do with those negotiations. And I think I have even managed to stick to my timetable, and I would now like to give the floor to my IDB colleague, and then happy to answer questions afterwards.